time to dim the lights and open your minds. Let yourself go. Travel along the many roads that populate the vast landscape of the paranormal on Parachallenged Radio with your host, PC. Parachallenged Radio is a Jackalope Radio production. Join us in the chat at www.parachallengedradio.com, or you can go to jackaloperadio.com in the shows area and click on the Parachallenged Radio banner. Don't miss the fun every Tuesday night, right here on Jackalope Radio. And now, your host into the wild world of the beyond, PC.
Welcome to Parachallenged Radio, everybody. It's Tuesday, and here we are. You're stuck with us for the next 2 hours, so sit down, buckle your seatbelt, and enjoy the ride. Keep your hands and feet inside the ride at all times until it comes to a complete stop. We have a great show for you. Really, we do. We have a great guest. Now, for me, I'm a little worried because, you know, being blonde and everything, he seems really smart. So I'm going to just kind of, you know, learn what I can and absorb what I can right along with you. And I hope you really enjoy our guest tonight because I have a feeling we will. Welcome to the show, Thomas Busco. I did it right. Yay!
All right.
That's right. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Oh, great. I'm so happy that you're here. Now, to tell the people a little bit about what you do, in your introduction section, you're an independent researcher who's devoted nearly 3 decades investigating the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomena, with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. That just blows my mind right there.
Well, it kind of blew my mind, too.
That's one hell of a resume.
Exactly. I'm impressed, and I don't know half of what I just said.
Well, the for me, I had a number of experiences that occurred in my teenage and early 20s that caused me to call into question the way the universe was put together. That I had to figure out how such things could be. And the standard science that I was taught didn't provide any answers for that. And I also realized that there were certain mysteries and enigmas of science as well that defied current explanation. And so for me, what I wanted to do was to try to find, as I wrote there, that cosmological framework that would draw a picture of the universe that would shed some light on how all these strange things take place. And so that's basically been the nature of my research.
Wonderful. Awesome. And this is what I'd like to see happening. A lot of people in the field just go out and investigate and don't ask, you know, don't develop any theories. And, you know, the theories are what's going to get us to advance the field even further than, well, I don't know, will it really ever go that far?
Well, I believe it will. You know, with the paranormal investigative teams, they go out there, they collect all this information, they collect all this evidence. But the problem is that they have the same challenges I faced many years ago, that they don't have a scientific framework into which to place all of these very disparate and different looking types of phenomena. I mean, what does an apparition actually have in common with a cold spot or a disembodied voice or any of the other kinds of different events that are observed? And so in the past, the only connective tissue, so to speak, that paranormal researchers have been able to come up with was the idea that some sort of a spirit is behind it. And so that may very well be true, but that's all they had to work on. In other words, they see an apparition, they say, well, a spirit is manifesting itself physically. They hear a disembodied voice. Well, the spirit is speaking. They feel a cold spot. Well, the spirit is draining energy from that place. In other words, the connective mechanism was always the spirit. And there was no physical model that would tell us how these things take place, how the spirit makes a voice audible out of midair. How does a spirit get its voice on a recorder when it's not heard audibly? This was the part of the puzzle that's always been missing.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And then they're saving up all their evidence and their information they've gathered, and not knowing what to do with it once they've got it. You know, it's nice to see that from the research I've done on you, that you're trying to advance what it is you're supposed to do with. What's the next step?
Well, the first step for me was to try to come down with some sort of a scientifically reasonable definition for what constitutes the paranormal. It's always traditionally been used as some sort of a catch-all basket where anything strange or weird gets dumped into this basket called the paranormal. And you have to have some sort of a solid starting point in order to begin to try to understand what's going on. So for me, that starting point was the idea that, to me, the paranormal are physical effects that can be observed, that interact with their surrounding environment, but has no direct physical cause connected to it locally to the event. Disembodied voice is a good example of what I'm talking about. We're talking with each other in normal voices. What makes our voice normal is that we have a set of vocal cords that is locally, physically connected to the effect of the sound that it's generating. That our vocal cords actually vibrate the airwaves and compress them in a pattern that can be conveyed through the air and then reach our ears or reach a recorder as a coherent, audible, legible voice. In a paranormal voice, all the effect is the same. The air, when you hear a disembodied voice, the air molecules are being compressed to a frequency and an amplitude that conveys a vocalization to your ears or to a recorder. All of that is normal. What's paranormal about it is there's no physical vocal cords locally connected to the effect of the voice. And so when we begin to start looking at it this way, it gives us a foundation from where we can begin to reason. Fortunately, we have other enigmas in the physical world that behave in this same way, in this way that physicists call non-locality or non-local causality. There are very many non-local causal effects that we see in quantum physics, which is why you see so many people trying to relate quantum physics with the paranormal. And something as common as gravity also behaves in the same way, that it really has no local particle or wave that conveys it. It's an effect with no direct physical connected cause, believe it or not. And in fact, I found gravity to be one of the keys to unlocking the mysteries behind these things. But that's the starting point, to come up with a solid definition as to what constitutes the paranormal, and then begin to reckon forward from there.
Absolutely. And we go into these people's houses, and it seems like the best we can do for them, as much as evidence as we gather and stuff like that, the best we can do for them is tell them, like, maybe yes or no, that their house is haunted or something like that. And that's, you know, really out there getting out of that is a confirmation and not really a answer to their questions, what's going on.
Yes, that's true. And that's a problem. It's a challenge. And so part of my work is certainly to, you know, try to give us something more than that, than just talking about, yes, you have a perpetrator in your house. We can't tell you about the forensics of the crime. We can't tell you how the perpetrator does what he or she is doing. But we can only tell you you have a perp there. I always kind of compare it to a police force, an investigative team on a police force, where they have criminologists and they have forensics. Well, we have thousands of criminologists in the paranormal, but I say that we have 0.25 forensics for every 1,000 criminologists. And so that's part of the challenge. If we understood the physics behind what was going on, I think we could have a greater handle on this.
Exactly. Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's really, it's a deep subject, really, when you start digging into it. Now, your cosmological model is based in part on a lost biblical cosmology that's been hiding in plain sight for centuries. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. There used to be, during biblical times, the religious principles that are expressed in the Bible were actually considered to be a cosmology. In other words, they saw the principles of God as extending to and relating to the entire creation, human beings just being a part of that creation, albeit a very significant part of that creation. But what happened with that, what I call the all-in-all principle, was that that broke down during the Age of Enlightenment. And the real pivot point was with Galileo. And so Galileo had proved with his telescope that the Earth indeed was not the center of the solar system, that it was the sun that was at the center. And the church had always held the view that the Earth was the center of the universe. And so when that was disproved, that discredited the church, and so they had to back up some. And then other scientific discoveries were made, and it seemed that with each scientific discovery that the church got one black eye after the other after the other. So what it eventually did was it withdrew from that all-in-all principle and said, okay, what we're going to teach is a spiritual religion relating solely to humanity, and everything else we're going to abandon. And so that's where that lost cosmology, where that cosmology of the Bible began to get lost. And of course, based on the model that they were working with, which was Aristotle's model, what they call the Aristotelian model, that was the one where the Earth was at the center, and the church had adopted that. And it also drew a picture of these crystalline firmaments that the planets and the stars were embedded in, and that was their model. So what I've done is said, well, let's go take a look at the 21st century model of what we have of the universe, and then go back and take a look at some of these characteristics and some of these principles that are spoken of in the Bible, and let's see if they resonate with this modern cosmology that we have. And sure enough, there are a lot of common things in the biblical principles that relate very closely. Just for one example, we consider the speed of light as being the uppermost barrier of the physical universe. And that is spoken of in the Bible over and over again in many different forms, that in the physical world, the closest thing there is to God is light. And so this was physically significant. So that's part of that hidden cosmology. Another part of it is the idea of good and evil. Now, when we're dealing with intelligent hauntings, we know from various observations that there often seems to be evil entities, that are involved with some of these phenomena. Some of them are considered demonic. And so there has to be a place physically for good and evil. That's always been looked at philosophically and religiously. What I've done is this. I've given a model where this could be understood physically. And what I talk about is this. Let's say we have the biblical God. He is all-knowing. He's all-seeing. He's eternal. There's no beginning or end. The Bible says that in him is no change or variation. Now, he decides he's going to create a universe that's just the opposite. It has changes. It has variations. It has differences. It had a beginning. And as most astrophysicists believe, it also will have some sort of an end to it. Certainly our local solar system will have an end when our sun burns up. And so all these qualities of the physical universe are exactly opposite to God. So the first consideration that we would have to come to realization of is that in order for God to make such a physical universe, he would have had to create it outside of himself, because it would not have been able to be sustained within himself. Time and space cannot coexist with eternity, or what we would call scientifically, we would call it infinity. That everything in the universe is finite. The instant you transform it to infinity, it loses its physical coherence. It ceases to be physical. So he had to create a universe outside of himself. But there's another problem. Everything we have in the physical universe is an expression of differences. Everything is dimensional. The spatial dimensions are a difference between here and there, in height, width, or depth. And the temporal dimension is a difference between then and now. It's time. And everything progresses through time. All processes move through time. It has a beginning and it has an end. It's measurable. Therefore, God needed to find a way to create differences that would give rise to a physical universe. So what he had to do was to have an adversary. And, of course, in the Old Testament, we know the word for Satan. The literal translation of it is adversary. And so you can imagine this absolute positive force and this absolute negative force, both being absolutely pure and unchanging in their nature, colliding together, conflicting with one another. And within that zone of conflict, we begin to give rise to the pre-material waves, the wave functions that will eventually materialize into physical reality. And so this is part of this cosmological model that's hidden in the scripture. Since the positive force, and again, we're going strictly by biblical terminology and the biblical concepts, since the positive force is greater than the negative force, they don't cancel each other out. If one was equal to the other, they would cancel each other out and you'd come up with a big goose egg. But because one force is greater than the other, it gives that conflict, those pre-dimensional waves, a direction. And so with that direction, we're able to draw a model, and I have it sketched out in my book, where that pre-material wave function, which is the formless matter of the Bible, and the structure, the order, which in the Bible is called the Word of God, combines together to trickle down and to decelerate below the speed of light. And as soon as it crosses the light barrier, it begins to materialize into physical reality. Now, this relates to the paranormal, in that this mechanism that I drew gives us a model by which we could understand how out of thin air, suddenly, we get an apparition. We have a partial materialization of an ordered body of information, and then it dematerializes. It falls back out of space-time.
Scary, but I think I actually followed you on that one. I really do.
I think so.
Wow, I think I amazed myself because I get your concept. I really do. It's very deep, but I get your concept, and it's incredible.
Yes, it is.
It is. If people are, those people who are familiar with the Einsteinian vision, what Einstein envisioned as the unified field, would actually recognize what I'm talking about. What he envisioned was a flat field of geometric space and time with areas of condensing in it, areas of concentration, like pimples on a flat plane. And he called those matter points. To him, space-time, matter, and energy was a continuum of one thing to another, which is where he derived the concept E equals MC squared, that matter and energy are two forms of the same substance. And what my model does, basically, what Einstein did, he looked at this from our physical reference point, and he saw this fabric of creation the way that I'm describing it. What I've done was to take from a spiritual point of view and look at it downward from above. In other words, it's just taking Einstein's vision and turning it upside down and taking a look at it from the other side. And then we can suddenly see all the points that drop down in space-time that materialize into physical reality.
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
That's actually understandable. That's actually understandable. And does this, I have to ask this, does this have anything to do, how does this connect in with time travel? Is it like, you know, we've had David Roundtree on one time, we were talking about wormholes and vortexes and stuff like that. Is there a connection between that and the speed of light and all that too, or is that just a separate entity?
No, it's all tied in. It's all a continuum. It's all related. David Roundtree says that my work, I'm the first human being that's ever given a credible challenge to his model. In fact, David Roundtree has actually conducted experiments already that have confirmed portions of my theory. And we're going to talk about that a little later.
Oh, yeah.
David Roundtree is one of my heroes. I don't know whether you know that or not. But,
mine too. Mine too. I got sucked into that book he wrote in Paranormal Technology. It's just a awesome book. I was just sitting there awestruck reading that. Just some of the stuff is like, he said you might get lost on chapter 6, but I hung right in there amazingly.
The man's a visionary. But what's interesting is that my model of my theory of everything, my cosmological model, is a very broad, all-encompassing model. But what it says essentially is this, is that if we take a small segment of reality and just look at it like looking through a window, let's say that little segment of reality that we're talking about is paranormal phenomena, the things that happen inside of a haunted house. According to my model, when we look through that window, we would expect to see certain things. And what now David has done, he's done extensive experimentation within that window. And so when we look through that window with the eyes of my model, we see the experiments that he has done has actually confirmed the things that my model would predict that we would see in that window. That's absolutely astounding.
Yes, it is.
Anyone that has a scientific background and is hearing this should probably somewhere on their head have some of their hair standing up, because this is so far beyond anything that's ever been presented or perceived before. This is really, really something new and different, and has an actual probability, I would say, of blowing the lid off of this whole mystery.
Absolutely, and this is real comforting to know that somebody spiritual and somebody scientific like David as working together, because you see so much of a conflict of that in the field. You see some people that just go completely to the spiritual side and thinks that every time something scientific comes out, it's, as you said, gives the spiritual a black eye, and then vice versa. And it's really comforting to know that people are working together from both aspects of that to prove what's going on.
Yes, and it's very, very exciting. One of the things that it does do for the first time is the way I look at it, and I'm a South Philly boy, and I was raised by a semi-pro boxer and weightlifter, and so I always got kind of a fight in me, so to speak. But I can go, rather than trying to get physicists and invite them over into the paranormal ring, so to speak, which most of them won't go, I can actually take what I have and go into their ring with them in their home field advantage and with their own ring rules and give them a black eye.
There you go.
But what I want to do, if we can, I want to talk a little bit about some of the details of this theory as they relate specifically to paranormal phenomena.
Most definitely, most definitely. You piqued my interest.
One of the premises that we have to begin with is that the universe is put together only one way. There is only one way that atoms are assembled. They can come together in different kinds of circumstances and environments, but there's only one way that they're put together. There is only one way that a photon travels, so to speak, and produces a light beam. What I tell people is that if you put a turkey in the oven 3 hours later, you're not going to open it up and find an eight-cylinder Ford engine. Reality isn't arbitrary like that. Everywhere in the universe where you have two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen combined in a molecule at what we call standard temperature and pressure, with a sufficient gravitational field to collect all those molecules in a pool, you will have a clear liquid that we call water anywhere in the universe that those conditions are met. There's no exception. We look out in the vast reaches of the cosmos, and we see light traveling from these distant objects, and we actually take that light and break it down through spectral analysis. We're able to judge a distance. We're able to figure out how fast that galaxy is moving. We can even tell things about the chemical composition of the stars within those galaxies. The reason being is because the math that we use to calculate that is the same math that works out there. Otherwise, it would be complete nonsense. So the universe is put together in one way. We know this. We're not sure exactly how it's put together completely, but we know this. Now, that means that paranormal phenomena, the things that we see in a haunted house, are consistent with the way that the universe is put together. In other words, the principles and the laws which govern the very way that the universe is assembled are the same laws and principles that govern how paranormal phenomena behave. It cannot be any other way. It's just that, you know, what I'm talking about is a shift in a paradigm. It's a different way of looking at things. It's like what I mentioned earlier about the ancients. When they looked up in the sky, they saw, in the night sky, they saw a glass firmament, a glass sphere, and they saw holes punched in it, and they saw light shining through those holes from the other side, and they saw each planet embedded in its own crystalline sphere that moved independently of all this. Now, when we look up in the sky today, anybody sees something very, very different than what the ancients saw. However, the funny thing is, the information that we're looking at that's coming through our eyes and going to our brains is the exact same information they saw 3,000 years ago. The difference is that the paradigm in our minds is so different. The laws and the principles that we use to judge that information that's coming to us from the sky. People don't realize sometimes that less than 100 years ago, up until the late 40s and the early 50s, physics, astrophysicists, the best in the science, believed that our galaxy was the known universe. That our galaxy, the Milky Way, was in fact the entire universe. And they saw these star clusters that looked like galaxies as just being concentrations of stars within that larger galaxy. Now we look at it and we see something completely different. The paradigm has shifted. So what we see in a haunted house should have correspondences with other parts of reality. So, for example, this is where I'm going to talk a little bit about gravity. And I think this will, you guys will get the picture here. Gravity is one of these things where I call it the elephant in the room. Where when we were in school, we were taught all about gravity. At least that's what we were told we were being taught about. We were taught all about gravity, but that's not true. What we were taught about was gravitational effect. We know quite a bit about gravitational effect. We know enough about it that we can actually design spacecraft and shoot them to the outer reaches of the solar system. But we don't really yet know what gravity is, the substance of it itself. We don't have a graviton or a gravity wave. So when we look at it for just what it is, instead of with an old paradigm that everything in the universe has to have a material explanation, which is why they believe there's a graviton and a gravity wave, even though decades of research has never found evidence of any of them. If we just look at it for what it is, we find out that there is nothing physical that is connecting, let's say, the Earth to the Moon. There's a gravitational effect that holds the Moon in its orbit around the Earth, but there's no physical connection. There's no physical component that's actually being projected from the Earth and touching the Moon physically, as there is like in electromagnetism. So what we find out is that gravity, by this paradigm, is itself a paranormal effect, where we have a physical effect that is observable, that's measurable, that interacts with its surroundings, but it has no locally connected direct physical cause. We have no graviton, and we have no gravity wave. It's what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Interesting choice of words.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So, we know that the bending of space is associated with the presence of gravity. That we understand that these two things coexist together. That anywhere we have the bending of space, we also have a gravitational field. This was one of Einstein's components of his theory of relativity that was later proved correct, that space is compressed and twisted and bent around the vicinity of masses. But we also have places in the universe where we see the bending of space where there is no adjacent mass. So we see gravitational fields and a resulting bending of space without any local physical cause directly connected to it. Now, everybody's heard of dark matter. This is the hypothetical make-believe substance that science has conjured to give a material explanation for the bending of space where there is no visible matter. And there's not a stitch of evidence that dark matter actually exists. The only compelling reason for it is the need for such an invisible matter in a strictly materialistic paradigm of the universe. There has to be a material cause. But I just look at it and say, you know what? Let's just take a look at it for what it is. Let's look at it exactly for what it looks like, that space can bend without a physical cause directly connected to it. And my book shows the model how that happens with that, what I was calling those pre-physical wave functions come down, and as they crest below the speed of light, they begin to bend space in different ways so that we see spatial bends without any associated matter sometimes. So if gravity is paranormal, if the bending of space is paranormal, what if we take that bending of space and bring it inside a haunted house? What would we see? And this is where it really gets cool, guys. Mm-hmm. You'll like this. Well, imagine that we have a bubble of space-time that swells up inside a haunted house. Let's not for a moment talk about what would cause that. We can get to that later. It's almost like the bending of space that would be around an object, but without the object. Imagine we have a ball that expands and swells within a haunted house. First thing that would do, it would create a compression of the space that's immediately around that ball. And what would happen is that any matter that was in that compressed space would become mechanically excited. It would be a compression of that material. So in a haunted house, let's say, for example, it's happening in the middle of a room, we have air molecules. We have atmosphere in there. So the molecules of the air would be crushed and compressed mechanically with this expansion of space. And what that would do would cause the electrons inside the orbits of the atoms to jump into their higher orbits. It would actually jump them up to a higher energy level. So the first thing that we would see is the forming of an electromagnetic field out of thin air.
Oh, man. That is awesome.
Okay. Now, that's from an idea to say, let's say if there's no dark matter in the universe and the gravitational bending that we see in the universe is happening from outside of the universe, and so it's paranormal, we can bring that bending and let's take it into a haunted house and see what happens, because it must be according to the way the universe is put together. Now, here's what's cool, guys. It gets even much cooler than this. Eventually, those electrons in their higher orbits are going to expend their energy, and they're going to drop back down into their lower orbits. And they'll eventually reach what they call zero-point energy. You've heard of that before. but when electrons drop back down into their orbits, they can emit two different types of things. One of the things that they can emit under certain conditions are photons. That's still a little bit of mystery in quantum physics, how an electron can emit a photon without the electron changing size or shape or geometric characteristics or lose any of its energy level. But it does do that. And we have a substance today or mechanisms today that do the same thing. We pass an electromagnetic field through a material substance. We agitate the electrons. The electrons jump up. They come back down. They emit photons, which are light. That's what's called an LED. That's a light-emitting diode. That's essentially how it works. So that's one thing that this field could emit. Another thing that the field could emit when these electrons drop down is thermal energy. So over the last couple decades, it's been much more common for paranormal investigators to take thermal imaging cameras inside these sites and look around with them. And people have picked up some very interesting images with these thermal cameras. I've seen a couple of them that are actually legible apparitions that you can see in these thermal images. But there's something a little strange about them. If you look at the thermal image of a living person, you'll see great variations in the thermal signature. You'll see patches of hot and cold areas on the face, the cheeks, as opposed to what the colors of the tip of the nose or the ears are. you'll see the clothes are much darker, the hair is much darker. There's quite a bit of variation because there's a thermal energy or a thermal engine, so to speak, inside of that body generating that heat. But when we look at all these paranormal thermal apparitions, we find that what they have in common is that their thermal signature is uniform across its entire surface. They do not have the same quality of image as an image of a living being does. Their signature, their heat signature, is more or less uniform across the whole image. Now, what that means is twofold. Number one, it means that the heat-generating mechanism is happening all around that surface at the same time. It's the same heat-generating mechanism that's at work on the entire image. And the second thing it means is that the mechanism is actually happening at the surface of this apparition, not at its core. And so when we put those two things together and we look at this idea of an electromagnetic field emitting thermal energy, it makes perfect sense. The images look exactly like what this model would predict that they would look like.
Oh, man.
Wow.
That's absolutely amazing, too, because I've always heard that it's when you take a... I've always took a compass into paranormal locations with me. I never knew why. You know, I was just looking for... I was told to look for variations in the magnetic field, but now that I know what I'm using it for, I feel a lot better about myself.
Well, this is what it's going to help us with, is that it's going to give us new and different ideas on how to conduct investigations. You know, rather than, we need to break out of this 19/20th century rut.
Mm-hmm.
But we only just needed a paradigm in order to do it. And so this is what's very helpful about this. Now, if I can interject something, if people have been visualizing what I've been describing, a ball of space-time jacketed in electromagnetic field and emitting photons, haven't I just described the first physical model of a luminous orb?
Mm-hmm.
That you did.
Absolutely.
Now, a standing bubble of sufficient size like that, that is kind of static, I've already had two paranormal investigators, when they've heard me describe this model, kind of almost gasp and interject and say, what you're describing is what we call a spirit vortex.
Okay.
Because it's actually a doorway into a higher dimension. All these things are being pushed down from above physical space-time. So let's go a little further. Let's go further down into the rabbit hole if you want.
Okay.
Let's go.
Okay. Now, we see these curves of space-time happening out in the cosmos with no adjacent visible mass. And we know that these things are happening inside of a vacuum. But in a haunted house, there's atmosphere, there's physical substances there. So when this kind of a bubble would open up in the presence of material, like air molecules, what you're going to have is it's going to create a temporary vacuum inside of it. Now, if it opens up very, very slowly, the laws of equilibrium will allow the surrounding air molecules and the associated thermal energy to seep into that vacuum and fill it up very quickly. It's like water seeking its own level. And we would see a very, very slight fluctuation on our instrumentation. But if it opened up real quick, faster than the laws of equilibrium would be able to fill that vacuum in, we would have a kind of effect as it would be if you got up in the morning on a winter's day and walked up to the front door and opened it real quick. You would have an inrush of air, and you would have a cold spot where the inside and the outside isn't able to equalize that quick. So you would have a temporary cold spot that would be the same dimension as this bubble. And if it was big enough and it happened fast enough, you would get one of those mystery breezes where you feel a quick breeze and there's no doors or windows open.
Oh,
so
man.
Here we're taking one phenomena after another, and we're fitting it into the single simple model. So that's a little deeper in the rabbit hole. Now, let's talk about an experience that many people have shared with me, that they say at the onset of a paranormal event in a haunted house that we have they get a feeling of heaviness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can attest to that.
You feel like the air's been sucked out, the air's been sucked out from around you, but you can still breathe, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, it's
and that
weird feeling.
That urge to look over your shoulder every 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Now, guys, you know, what I've observed, being the armchair theorist that I am, you know, I'm like an armchair quarterback. But what I've observed is that almost every single person who describes this experience uses the very same word. It's not such a subjective feeling that you get 10 different people give you 5 or 6 different words for it. It's like 99 out of 100 people use the same word, heavy. And we all know, all of us human beings, we all know what heavy means. You know, we know what weight is. We've been in a roller coaster. We know what a G-force is. We all use the very same word. So you have to give it a lot of credibility. Well, now, this is interesting. If we go back to what we talked about that was always associated with the bending of space, it would be a gravitational field. And so this bending of space would create an additional and independent gravitational field from that of the Earth, and so it would increase the G's of everything in its influence, and so we would literally have a feeling of heaviness.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, it does, and it just makes everything kind of come together.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, you know, sometimes we get that feeling of heaviness too. We get what I've heard a lot of people describing as it feels like electric spider webs dragging across you. What kind of gives you that sensation?
Well, imagine if where your body was being occupied, where your body was occupied in space, that you suddenly had the space that your body was occupying bend and an electromagnetic field form at the surface of that bend. Imagine what that would do to your nervous system.
Oh, yeah.
It would have the same kind of effects that people describe. Pins and needles, hair standing up on end, goosebumps. Sometimes people get headaches, they get nauseous. If you were bending the space in your gut, I'd throw up too if you didn't. You know? You know, this would all be consistent with this particular physical model. Now, if we can take a minute, I want to go a little deeper in the rabbit hole even still.
Okay, let's tie a rope around us. I don't want to get lost.
That's it. Take a red pill.
We're going to begin to talk about the second part of this theory.
Okay.
And this one's a little bit more complex. So I'm going to try to explain it the best way I can. Of course, the book walks you through very, you know, systematically, step by step. I've written it in a very easy to understand way. In fact, that's what took some of the years to write it, to keep rewriting it and writing it and writing it until it would make sense to anybody.
Right, and that's what's important about that. And we'll talk about that when we, you know, in the second half, when we really focus on the book. But this is just, you know, I really give you kudos for that, because if I could understand the first chapter, you did an amazing job. So,
well, thank you very much. All right, let's go a little bit deeper into the rabbit hole here. One of the aspects of this theory is based on the idea of information. This is something that established physics has been increasingly aware of, especially in the computer age. The core concept of this is that everything in the universe is an expression of information. And in fact, we've all heard the conservation laws in school that matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed. In recent decades, physicists have come up with an addendum or an extension of that law that says information can neither be created nor destroyed. So, and this is one of their problems with black holes, because they can't figure out how information cannot be destroyed and get sucked into these things. But anyway, if we look at this kind of model that I draw in my book, in the theory, what we have is that physical reality, physical objects, let's say, for example, it's always been thought about from a material point of view that a mass, let's say like the sun, exerts a gravitational field which bends the space around it. Remember, we're talking about the bending of space in relation to this theory, what I call my super geometric theory. But according to this model, the picture of reality is the exact opposite. In other words, the bending of space creates the effect known as gravity, in the middle of which information materializes in the matter. So rather than mass causing gravity and the bending of space, it's actually the bending of space which materializes mass. It's the exact opposite of what the material model of the universe has always been. Now, that means that everything we know about gravitational effect would still be the same, but it would tell us something about the way the universe is actually put together. So let's talk about an apparition for a minute. Let's say we see an apparition of a 19th century Victorian lady. I always like to talk about them, dressed in white. Seems to be a stereotypical apparition. But let's say this lady is someone who lived 120, 130 years ago in that house. Now, when she was alive, her body, her dress, where she was walking, her height, the features of her face, everything, is all comprised of materialized information. So if you can imagine now, if we had one of these expanding bubbles of space-time, and this information dropped down from outside of space-time into this sublight bubble, which is what is happening as space bends, it drops below the speed of light, then that information that's dropping in that bubble would begin to materialize in the same way that it's fully materialized 130 years in the past. And you see the image, the partially materialized image of that 19th century Victorian lady.
Wow.
Oh, man. That's amazing right there.
Now, you were asking me earlier about time travel. Well, according to my model, time travel is not possible within the confines of space and time. But this information is stored independently and separately from space-time. It's stored outside of space-time. And when we get to the speed of light, when we approach the speed of light, the dimensions of space and time begin to collapse in on themselves. If we were able to go above the speed of light, time would collapse completely. That dimension would collapse into what we would call a singularity, which means at that point, at the point of singularity, the past, the present, and the future are occurring simultaneously. It is eternity or infinity. So if this information was to drop down from that singularity, it's actually being materialized in two different time coordinates at the same geographic location. So in other words, the information that materialized the lady that lived 130 years ago is the same information that's materializing in the apparition in front of us now. So although the lady herself didn't transport through time, the information from which she is constructed has traveled from the past based on our reference point, or from her reference point 130 years ago, her information has traveled into the future. And so in paranormal phenomena, we have real-time evidence of time travel.
Wow.
That is awesome.
Okay, still trying to bend my mind around that, but that's... yeah, wow.
And this is all great stuff, because we can just, this is something we can actually, you know, use as a launching point to go out and do further investigation. You're not just going out there and just getting the yeses and the noes of the house being haunted, but why, and help the people get the answer.
Yes. I've had a couple of investigators listen to my, some of my interviews, and they've said, now when we go out into a haunted house and investigate, we actually have an understanding of what's happening in front of our eyes.
And Rich in the chat room just said, by applying some of these theories, you may be actually giving the field, or many of them in the field, the answers that they've been seeking for years, by actually being able to piece these theories together and really being able to walk away with something they understand.
Yes. And moreover than that, guys, I've always felt that the field of paranormal research held the true keys to understanding some of the mysteries of the universe and the way it's put together. David Roundtree and myself have been talking with each other, and we both believe that if we continue to travel this path with his technological and scientific skills and his experimental experience, and my theoretical model, that we may be able to submit to the mainstream body of science the first scientific paper on paranormal phenomena.
Wow.
That's absolutely awesome.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. We're going to go head into break, and everybody can absorb everything they've heard in the first half. And when we come back, we'll pick up where we left off, and then we'll get to information on your book, which the chat room is already talking about. They want to buy it and read it a gazillion times till they understand it, which is great. And I definitely will recommend it, and I'm going to buy a copy myself as well. But we'll be getting more into that in the second half. Everybody, don't go away. This is great stuff. This is what we've been craving in this community.
Absolutely.
So don't go away. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this quick break. You're listening to Parachallenge Radio. I'm Jackalope Radio. Don't go away.
Probably would have smoked them all. So I'm out on the couch this afternoon. this afternoon. Oh, better hang on if you're tagging along, 'cause we'll be doing this till 6 in the morning. Nothing wrong with going all night long. Tough to put the brakes on, doesn't matter when you'd rather get up and go out. Me and all my friends, we drink up, we fall. The human race, if you ain't living on the edge, you're taking too much space. So I doubt I'll figure out just what to do. I'm about to kick it around, but hanging out this afternoon. Oh, better hang on if you're tagging along, 'cause we'll be doing this till 6 in the morning. Nothing wrong with going all night long. Tough to put the brakes on, doesn't matter when you'd rather get up. Me and all my friends, we drink up, we fall down, then we do it all again. Yeah, we get up, we go out. Me and all my friends, we drink up, we fall.
Welcome to Parachallenge Radio News, PCRN. My name is Brian Watley. This is your news segment for this ghostly Tuesday night. Your dead-on top news stories are...
About Cabin in the Woods, Bubba Earns Cheers, Boys in the Band, and 15,000 March Winter Records. Our first story tonight is Cabin in the Woods with Josh Weldon's Ode to Horror scares up buzz among genre fans. Yes, filmmakers had a real chore keeping the script secret during auditions and shooting. And this is brought to us by Ethan Sachs, published April the 8th, 2012. And you can find this on the NewYorkDailyNews.com. There's not much a reporter can reveal about The Cabin in the Woods. Well, except that it's not about either a pterodactyl attack or a possessed hot tub that menaces its scantily clad bathers. The actors who were auditioning for writer-director Drew Goddard and writer-producer Joss Whedon's ultra-secret project several years ago, however, didn't go in knowing that. The best way I know to spoil anything is to send scripts to actors and tell them, "Don't give this to anyone," says Goddard, a first-time director who cuts his fangs writing for Whedon's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. "Because we need to look at hundreds and hundreds of actors. We wrote a bunch of fake scenes and the scenes were ridiculous," he says. "But it was important to see how people would react to that and how actors would roll with it. And somewhere we have an audition tape of, well, you know, Chris Hemsworth reacting to a pterodactyl attack that's priceless," he quips. The shroud of secrecy is a big part of the mystique surrounding The Cabin in the Woods, which opens Friday after being stuck in the hellish limbo that was MGM's bankruptcy. Goddard and Weddard tried the usual tricks of the trade during filming, read pages for the screenplay so they couldn't be photocopied or scanned, but ultimately prayed the genre geek and geeks, and would they even police themselves? Well, then a funny thing happened on the way to the multiplex. A fan base notorious for internet spoilers has done just that. They kept their trap shut. I think that everybody who had the movie knew a huge part of the film is not knowing, and you are kind of sabotaging yourself if you tell anybody, says Richard Jenkins, one of the few actors entrusted with a real script from the outset. I didn't tell my wife, really. I didn't tell my friends. I just said, no, you're just going to have to see it. Jenkins almost divulges more during the interview but catches himself. I'm relying on you, and he says to edit this, he says, I'm relying on you, Ethan. The plot is really about five college students, the bookish good girl, a surprisingly smart alpha male jock, his promiscuous girlfriend, a sensitive scholar athlete, and the requisite stoner comic relief. Well, there is for a weekend getaway that the audience knows that it isn't going to end well. Only the periodic cuts to a computer center, staffed by wisecracking engineer types played by Jenkins and Bradley Whitford, hint at a deeper mystery. And our next story is Bubba Earns Cheers and Masters Win. This is brought to us by Art Spander on April the 9th, 2012. You can find information on realclearsports.com. He's not exactly a good old boy, but Bubba Watson is from the South. Well, he's from Baghdad, Florida, to be exact, and he did go to the University of Georgia, and he does button his golf shirt to the top for neatness, so that the fans at Augusta National late Saturday, Sunday afternoon were acting as if they were at, say, a Georgia-Florida game, that was excusable. Bubba, 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 they were chanting. He had just won a playoff for the Masters, and while he was crying, they were screaming, Bubba, Bubba, Bubba. He was the homeboy whose father had died a couple of years ago, and who, along with his wife Angie, had adopted a baby a few months ago, and down in Dixie, they wouldn't be worked up about these things. The fans at the Masters, they're listed as patrons. And we're not against the guy Watson beat in the playoff, who is the South African Louise. They just were enthralled with the way Watson came flying down from those famous finishing holes at Augusta National 13, 14, 15, and 16 with consecutive birdies. And it didn't hurt that Bubba is an American, given the U.S. following King and Bradley's PGA Championship last year. It's second straight major after non-Americans had won the previous six. Bubba is a 32-year-old blend of monster drives and emotion. He can hit balls halfway to the moon, or so it seems. That wedge out of the trees on the second extra playoff hole was headed for orbit, but unfortunately came down on the green. And he can talk as fast as a ball moves against Augusta's slick greens. We all like to say, congratulations, Bubba. Way to win that Masters and wear that green jacket. Our next story is about boys in the band, Keith Urban, Vince Gill, to back stars at All for the Hall Benefit Concert. This is brought to us by the Associated Press on April the 9th, and you can find this on WashingtonPost.com. Imagine the rush of singing in front of thousands of fans, then turning around to find Keith Urban and Vince Gill in your band. And that's the experience some of country music's top stars will have at the All for the Hall Benefit Concert at the Bridgestone Arena on Tuesday night. Urban and Gill, as musical directors for the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum fundraiser, have merged their bands and are sitting in all night. It would be awesome if we could keep it this way forever, Little Big Town's Karen Fairchild said after rehearsals Monday afternoon. I don't think we could afford it, bandmate Kimberly Schlappman said. But it is amazing to be up front singing and turn around and there's Keith Urban and Vince Gill. I'm like, yeah, I'm impressed with myself, says Kimberly. And it makes you feel important, doesn't it? Fairchild asks. Both Gill and Urban come from band backgrounds and weren't about to pass up the chance to be part of the band again. I love playing, Gill said. I like being invited to play, and I like it when people think enough of my playing to invite me to play, and you never grow tired of that. The first two All for the Hall benefits raised about $1 million this year, and this year's installment sold out in a day. Our next story is the U.S. sets more than 15,000 March weather records, the NOAA says. And this is brought to us by Brian K. Sullivan on Monday, April 9th, and you can find more information on sfgate.com. Well, you know, sometimes when we talk about the weather here on PCR News, it isn't really all that much. A little bit of rain and some snow and some blizzards and all that other good stuff. But 15,000 temperature records were broken in the U.S. last month, and the country had its first 1 billion weather disaster of 2012, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The average temperature in the contiguous U.S. was 51.1 degrees Fahrenheit, or 8.6 degrees above the 20th century average, and 0.5 degrees more than the previous all-time high set in 1910, according to NOAA. Well, only one month in January 2006 has seen a larger departure from its average temperature than March 12th, according to NOAA's statement. Temperatures in the heating season, which runs from October to March, were 3.8 degrees above average, making it the second warmest on record behind 1999 to 2000, according to NOAA. And natural gas prices have fallen 30% this year, partially because of the warmer weather and rising production. Well, across the U.S., 15,292 warm temperature records were set or tied, according to NOAA. And every U.S. state set a daily record, and 25 states east of the Rocky Mountains had their all-time hottest. In addition, 15 states had monthly temperatures in the top 10. And the warm weather also contributed to 223 reported tornadoes in the U.S., more than 80 normally seen during the month. A tornado outbreak on March the 2nd to March the 3rd across the Ohio Valley in the southeastern U.S. killed at least 40 people and caused more than $1.5 billion in damage. It is the first $1 billion weather-related disaster of the year. And last year, the U.S. experienced 14 weather-related disasters that caused $1 billion in damage or more. The first 3 months of 2012 has had an average temperature of 42 degrees, which is 6 degrees above average and the warmest on record, according to NOAA. Well, of course, you can find a more detailed analysis of March's weather when it's released at the New York Times. And I would just like to go on and say one of the more important reasons of bringing this story to your attention is really what happens about all the paranormal stuff when it starts warming up. Things start getting hotter? It's kind of interesting. 15,000 temperature records. I wonder what the sightings were according to that. Anyway, think about it.
If you have any other stories, items, or events you would like mentioned on PCRN, please send an email to parachallengeradio@live.com. Attention, PCR News. And that's all for PCRN. I am your Parachallenge Radio news anchor, Brian Watley. I am the director of Ghost Hunters of the South, located out of Mobile, Alabama. You can find us on the web at www.ghots.net. That's GHOTS.net. And you can email us through contact@ghots.net. Our team is a proud TAPS family member. Thank you for tuning in, and it's time for Lights Out.
You're listening to Parachallenged Radio with your host, PC, a Jackalope Radio production.
We're back, and yes, I did say before the break, probably more than once. And my 9,000
times.
Shush, you, every time you say it, I say it more. So yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. But anyway, we are back, and we have more incredible information to share with you from our wonderful guest, Tom Fusco. Thank you for being with us for the full 2 hours and for sharing all of this incredible information. My brain is spinning, but in a good way.
Well, thank you very much for having me as a guest. I'm really glad to be here.
We're glad to have you on. This has been awesome.
We definitely are. Now, where did we leave off? Where do you want to pick up and continue this before we go into the discussion of your book and your website? And there's a lot of information to cover there. So where do you want to start off?
Well, I wanted to talk, if I can, about two other phenomena that are associated with hauntings. And one of them is EVPs. And so I wanted to talk about a little bit about how EVPs fit into this model that I'm talking about.
Okay.
All right. Now, if we go back and if you recall, what we were talking about is a bending of space, like a bubble opening up in space-time, and information materializing inside of that bubble. And that's how we see things like apparitions. But now, what if we were to have a disembodied entity, and I try to use these words very loosely, if we had an intelligence, which is a coherent collection of information, just like the intelligence that we have in our brains comprises information, but it had no physical body, but yet it still had the capabilities of trying to speak. So if you think what your brain would try to do when it speaks something, but if it had no body to actually speak through, no vocal cords, no mouth, nothing like that physically, well, that speech would be a collection of coherent information. Now, if that information dropped down from the higher realm, so to speak, what I call the super geometric realm, above space-time, and that information for that voice dropped down into a bubble of space-time and began to materialize in it, just like the information that comprised a 19th century lady would begin to materialize and we would see that bubble take the form of that woman, the voice, the information that comprises a voice, if it starts materializing in one of these bubbles, what it would do is begin to vibrate that bubble according to the frequency and amplitude of the materializing information of that voice. So what that would cause two effects. One of the things it would do, and this is what's crazy about it, this is what's fun about this, is that the actual surface of space would act like the paper of a speaker. It would actually represent a form of vocal cords. And so when that face of that bubble begins to vibrate at the frequency and amplitude of the materializing vocal information, it will actually agitate and compress the air molecules surrounding that bubble according to that oscillation, that frequency and amplitude of that voice, and we would literally hear a disembodied voice come out of midair. Literally. Because the actual face of space itself is acting like a speaker, vibrating and agitating the air molecules that reach our ear, and you hear a voice.
Wow.
That's awesome. That's absolutely awesome.
Yeah. This is what's great about this. Here's the other thing it would do. Remember when I talked about earlier that this expanding of space would create an electromagnetic field? Well, if a vocalization is materializing inside of that bubble, it would also create an electromagnetic compression that would also vibrate to the frequency and amplitude of the materializing voice. Now, in this instance, you wouldn't hear it because at the frequency, at the wavelength it's happening, it's not agitating the air molecules, but it is creating a fluctuating electromagnetic field. And that field projects forward. It induces itself directly on the copper coils of a recording microphone, bypassing the diaphragm in the microphone. And then, of course, the device would translate that oscillating field in those copper coils to an audible voice. And you would pick up an EVP on the recorder where no one could audibly hear the voice who was present.
That's awesome. And that puts it in perspective because we're just, you know, a lot of us, our main staple is going by EVPs and stuff in this field. And it's, you know, you almost think of it like, you know, you can hear a train on a foggy or rainy night better than you can hear it on a summer night. You know, and it's almost like that, what you're describing is that perfect gravitational force there, and the electromagnetic feels almost like having that foggy night that you can hear something come through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is where it gets even crazier. When I was comparing notes with David Roundtree, here's what I found out. All right. One of the things that this would predict, which again, guys, I have to back up for a second and talk about science again. You've heard about a lot of theories, about a lot of metaphysics, about a lot of philosophies. What defines a scientific theory is that it makes predictions that are testable. That's what separates a scientific theory from a theory. The multiverse is a theory. It's not a scientific theory because it's impossible to test. But supergeometry is a scientific theory. So one of the predictions it would make, if we're talking about this oscillating electromagnetic field that induces itself directly on the coils of a microphone, one of the predictions it would make is that you would be able to pick up EVPs inside of a vacuum. And, of course, we know David Roundtree has conducted that experiment. Another thing that it would predict is that if you took a tape recorder and you actually surgically removed the acoustic diaphragm, that recorder would still pick up EVPs because it's an electromagnetic function. And once again, David Roundtree has conducted an experiment that verified this. This is where him and I were comparing notes and said, this is crazy. one of the other things that this would do is that when one of these bubbles opened up, it would cause a differentiation between the barometric pressure inside the bubble and outside the bubble. David Roundtree has confirmed that experimentally. Another thing it would do, we talked about with the bending of space, it would create its own gravitational field. David Roundtree has also confirmed this by measuring at the moment of an EVP recording gravitational fields on three axes. In other words, a three-dimensional field, not just a fluctuation in the one-dimensional or the one-directional field of the Earth, where all the lines of gravity point to the center of the Earth, but a bubble that is expanding out in three dimensions. He's already experimentally verified this. He just didn't have this model before. And then, one other thing, we understand from Einstein that space and time are joined into one substance, into one continuum called space-time. So if we're bending space, we're bending time as well. And that means that we would also detect time dilation and time compression at the location of these paranormal events. And once again, guys, David Roundtree has experimentally confirmed this fluctuation, this distortion in time.
That's just absolutely awesome. I love how David puts all the stuff out there, the in the book and on his spirit group site on Facebook. He just has all these experiments out there that you can actually go and do everything he did yourself and explains it down to the T how to do it. So that makes me looking forward to reading your book to put up the two and two together.
The really important thing that we have to mention here is that you are working together. You know, you're forming your own individual theories, but then you're coming together and, you know, comparing notes and really working together. And there's sadly not enough of that going on right now, or I think we'd get a lot farther in the field.
Well, I think that once this becomes more publicized, then those people who are really into finding answers, because we were talking about during the break, there's a faction of every discipline who is not interested in finding answers. They don't want anybody to solve the problem because their excitement, their interest in the field that they're in is in the mystery, you know, in the mystique of it. And this kind of, you know, this is kind of thing like the emperor has no clothes. Well, David Roundtree and myself are talking about the clothes. A lot of people don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. But for those who do, the publicizing of this is going to make this more and more widespread, and people are going to get into this experimentation. For example, I'll give you one example how this would expand our thinking about how we investigate a site. One of the phenomena that's commonly reported is the malfunction of electrical equipment at the site of paranormal events. Well, typically, it's been thought of that spirits are somehow draining the batteries in order to physically manifest. Well, when you look at the physics, it's just not there. They base that loosely on Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, that matter and energy can be converted back and forth from one form to the other. But the part of the equation that they don't really grasp is how much energy would be necessary to generate a manifestation of matter. Just to give you an example of scale, the entire energy output of the sun is not sufficient to form 1 ounce of matter. The disproportion is incredible. So you wouldn't be talking about, you know, a flashlight flickering or get a cold spot 3 feet across of 20 or 30 degrees. You would be talking about how many square miles just dropped to absolute zero, negative 273 degrees centigrade, where everybody and everything froze solid, just to get a fraction of a second cigarette smoky mist of material substance. The physics isn't there. Plus the fact that when we go over to the UFO side of the paranormal, we see the exact same phenomena, that in close vicinity of UFOs, batteries go dead, cars stop, radios don't work, flashlights don't work. But in that genre, nobody ever thinks that the UFO is trying to drain your ever-readies to physically manifest. The reason being is because they're not thinking about a ghost. So the physics isn't there. However, the physics is well established that at certain frequencies and amplitudes, electromagnetic fields can interfere with electrical equipment. We know that. That's established fact. It's been known for a while. We have weapons built on EMF pulses that would disable these type of devices. So here's an idea for research. Instead of just bringing in EMF meters to measure the quantity of the field, we also need to bring oscilloscopes, which they make in micro form now, that will measure the quality of the field. And I'll bet you this is another one of my predictions. We will begin investigative team after investigative team to discover at the same frequency. Suddenly, that's when the electrical equipment begins to malfunction. And we'll all get those same frequencies no matter where we're testing.
Interesting.
Very awesome.
Quite interesting. Wow. I hope everybody's listening. I really do.
Hope you're taking notes out there.
Exactly. This is what it's all about, really, to further advance, you know, and understand and really put the pieces together.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. And just so the audience, people in the audience understand, my book is not actually like David Rowntree's book that's specifically focused on the paranormal. My book draws a larger picture of reality and just uses the paranormal as one of the many bodies of evidence that verify this model. I talk about spirituality, biblical elements that we talked about earlier. I talk about things like evolution and how this helps us understand evolution, how order came out of chaos. It has predictions about what the Big Bang was like, and it's a little bit different than the standard model, and also talks about why we can't find a graviton or a gravity wave or the trouble they're finding trying to find a Higgs boson. So this is very comprehensive, but there's a big old chapter on the paranormal, which I think everybody in that field would really appreciate. Plus, it answers a lot more questions than just in that field.
Absolutely. And a lot of people's not, you know, it seems like everybody's in a scramble to get the first piece of evidence, but they'll just put anything out there that they get and not really put reasoning behind it, or, you know, and it's stuff that can be easily written off too. It's just, you know, lens flares and stuff like that, and they're just, it seems like they're more scrambling to find the easy fix than to actually get in there and see what's going on and get the real answers to what's going on.
Yeah, but you know, for me, with all due respect, because like I said, I'm an armchair quarterback, but I have the most respect for the actual quarterback, his or herself, that actually goes out in the field and does the hard work. So I have a lot of respect for what they do, but what they've been hampered by is not having some kind of a physical model in which to fit all this information. And so what they're stuck in is kind of what I compare it to, like a professional bass fishing circuit, where all the different fishermen go to this one lake to the next, and all they do is see who can catch the most fish and the biggest fish. Mm-hmm. And that's what investigators are stuck in a rut right now. They go to one haunted lake, so to speak, after the next, seeing how much they can catch. And so I'm hoping that this will, you know, help break us out of that mm-hmm. and reach the next level for the 21st century, so to speak.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we had a question from chat earlier. It's a good time to get into this one. Is do you think paranormal investigators will be better off? It bumped on me. Do you think paranormal investigators will be better off coming from a metaphysical naturalism point of view rather than using the terms of paranormal and supernatural?
Well, I think that traditionally paranormal, supernatural, philosophical, and metaphysical has all been from the same approach. It has given different, how would I say it? It has proposed different belief systems to try to explain what's going on. So in my opinion, I would say that there's a place for that. And that's what I call kind of the criminology of it, where people are actually looking into the spirits themselves. Who are these entities? What are they? Why are they haunting this house? Why are they doing the kinds of things that they're doing? So all of that, the spiritual and the metaphysical, applies to that. So I would say that's valid, but what we also need to do is to begin to concentrate on the physics, the forensics of it. And now with this model, we're able to do that. David Rowntree has called my work the first roadmap of the paranormal that we can begin to actually construct targeted experiments with. So I think both are necessary.
Awesome.
Very
that
cool.
is fabulous. I just got a question, too, from the chat. Do you think it would be beneficial for investigators to understand how quantum physics / mechanics work to become better investigators?
No, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. This is what is one of the funny things about my model, that traditionally people have tried to use quantum physics to define the paranormal. Well, because my model is universal, it covers pretty much the way the universe is put together on a whole. What my model actually does is uses paranormal phenomena to define quantum physics. And so rather than paranormal being quantum physical, what I say is quantum physics is paranormal. And so it turns the tables, so to speak. I don't think paranormal investigators need to understand the quantum mechanics of all this, although it would be kind of exciting to get into for them. I think what they need to do is to use a model by which they can begin to fine-tune their evidence collecting. And this will create a body of evidence that will actually be meaningful to mainstream science.
Wow. Okay.
Very cool.
All right. Cool. Well, I think it's time to jump into where to find your website and how to order this phenomenal book. And I only read the first chapter. Now I'm addicted and I need the rest. So the website link is www.cosmicveil.com. Cosmicveil.com. V-E-I-L is veil. Go there. You know, read what's on the website and just, you know, order your book. Order it right from that website. definitely interesting material and articles and all kinds of things there to read. You know, more information than, you know, I can't imagine what more is in the book from what's already on your website.
Well, it talks, one of the chapters is Fantastic Possibilities. And what this talks about is this. Okay, let's take the evidence, the body of evidence in paranormal phenomena, and let's look at it for a second. What do we see? We see the spontaneous materialization of tangible, understandable, legible information. We see it dematerialize. We see evidence for that information to be able to travel through time and space, bypassing both. Now imagine if we were able to understand the science sufficiently to exploit it technologically so that we could actually have teleportation or time travel, or if someone has a failing organ, that we can rematerialize it from its original non-physical information, or we can identify metastasizing cancers inside of a body by their supergeometric pattern and literally teleport them out of somebody's body and heal them, or that we would have an infinite form of energy, that we could literally build electromagnetic fields out of thin air and, you know, light bulbs and run devices according to Tesla's original dream of having information or energy come out of the air without any wires. The ramifications are incredible. We could build ships that would do the very same things that we see UFOs do. Travel at incredible speeds with no visible means of propulsion, just like in a poltergeist event where we see large objects fly across the room as if they were weightless with no visible means of propulsion. I believe that there's intelligent creatures that have built UFOs. They've already done this, guys. They have cracked the cosmic code of creation, the same thing that makes paranormal phenomena work, and then they've built technology on it, where they can collapse the space-time bubble around their craft so it dematerializes, and then rematerialize their information at the other side of the galaxy. It's mind-boggling. The ramifications of this are that it could open up a door for us where we could be able to do whatever it is that our minds can imagine.
That is awesome.
Wow.
Because remember something, this is another thing about my theory. We were talking earlier about the way the physical universe is put together.
Right.
Okay. Well, scientifically speaking, every system operates according to a given set of principles and laws. That means, even if we don't understand them fully, that means that every subset of that system must operate in a way that is consistent with those same laws and principles. That it cannot operate in a way that's contrary to or outside of that laws and principles. Our human brains and our intelligence is a subset of the universe. That means the very convolutions of our brains and the kind of thoughts that pass through them are according to the same order and structure that created the universe in which they're a subset. That's why we look at a tree and we can intelligently perceive what it is, because the order that established the structure of that tree is the same order and work that are inside of our brains. That's, to me, that's the definition of intelligence.
That's awesome. And I love how it just now you're like just connecting all this stuff and it's all just relating to each other.
Yeah. When we have let's take psychic phenomena. Let's take telepathy. Okay. That's transferring of a thought from one brain to another. Now follow me a little bit, because I'm going to use the same model that we were talking about in telepathy. Remember the 19th century Victorian lady back in her time, where she had the body, but also had the material, or rather the information that comprised that body. Now let's take a look at thought. Let's think about thought as the information, and its body is the electrochemical functions that we measure in the brain associated with thought. Let's think of those electrochemical functions in the brain as the thought's body. You follow me so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Now, in telepathy, that thought transfers from one mind to another outside of any known physical conduit. We know it works even inside of a Faraday cage. So there is no physical connection between the two minds. So here we have the thought, which is the pure information. It separates itself from the electrochemical functions in brain A. It travels outside of space-time, drops into brain B, and as soon as that thought drops into brain B, the electrochemical components of that thought's body instantly materializes in that second brain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually kind of get that. That's you know, you never thought of it from that, I've never thought of it from that point of view before. That's mind-boggling.
Definitely.
Now think about this, about the human brain. See, this is what's so different about this, guys, and even me still. You know, I'm getting goosebumps talking about this to you, and I've been working on it for 30 years. But when I think about it, it's just so incredible. What do our human brains do? Take a look around you, where you're sitting. Everybody in the audience, take a look at that computer that's sitting in front of you. That can never happen in nature. There is no amount of natural selection or natural random processes that would ever create an IBM PC and the x86 programming language that runs it. It never happened naturally in nature. So what is it? It's materialized information. Where did the information come from? The human brain. The human brain is a perfect arena for the materialization of information in the real world. It all starts coming together. And it's all with a simple model. Einstein said a good physical theory would be one that even a six-year-old might understand. And he always told the things about string theory and all those other kinds of things. He called them unnecessarily complex. This, I believe, is what we've all been looking for.
Absolutely.
I think so.
And it's just, and it's, you know, I'm looking really forward to reading this book, and it's, you know, I read David's book, and it sounds like you guys are on the same page, and you guys are out there, you know, making this stuff happen and actually looking for the answers. And it's just, it's real exciting just thinking that we have all these real things to go on now, instead of just stuff that we're hearing coming down the line, or just the very tip of the iceberg stuff that we're getting to use as investigators.
Yeah, I've been one of my missions, so to speak, in being with all these interviews with the paranormal community, is that people would begin to start picking this up and saying, hey, you know, here's a model, and hey, now let's look at the cutting edge, like what David Roundtree's doing, and seeing what he's doing with that equipment, and putting the two together and begin to walk on this path. You know, one of the things this would do for us, too, it would begin to, and you have to forgive me, I don't want to offend anyone. Please bear with me. But, like, for example, during my searching through paranormal radio shows, trying to find ones who would want me to be a guest, I encountered certain sites where you go on the website and you hear the weird music and you see the bats flying around and the pictures of the people with all the demonic tattoos and, you know, the gothic dress with the black fingernail polish and the, you know, and the flashlights under their chin. Man, what do you think it is? The Dark Ages? you know, my gosh, you guys are killing us. You guys that are doing that are killing us. You're destroying this. You're making anybody who has any kind of scientific mind whatsoever run so fast for the door, it's like people in a nightclub on fire.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the more serious researchers have a model and they can begin to build specific evidence and say, we predicted this frequency, this distortion in time. We put up this experiment in this haunted site, and we got these results. And when we do the same thing somewhere else, we get the same kind of exacting measurements like David Roundtree is doing. And we'll make all this medieval stuff go bye-bye. It needs to go away, guys. Otherwise, we'll never, ever be taken seriously. And paranormal research, like I said earlier, I believe holds the key to unlocking the actual structure of reality so that we could build technologies that we can't even dream of today. Well, we've got to make the medieval stuff go bye-bye.
One of the sad facts of this whole thing is, now that it's everything's based upon money and fame and thrill seeking and all that, I really hope people are listening and paying attention to the messages you're putting out there, because this is what it's all about, folks. This is where the real meat and potatoes of the whole paranormal is going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Brian and I and anybody else who's lived through this crazy stuff is finally going to get a shot at getting the answers that why was my child seeing a lady at 3 years old and able to describe exactly what she was wearing? This is where this is going to be answered, within this realm, not in who's selling more tickets to what event and who's doing this and who did who wrong. And, you know, mm-hmm. It's a bad country song right now.
Oh, yeah. My. You know, it's like, you know, I was a bit naive. Because, again, I was, when I got into the radio interviews, I started really getting into, you know, what's going on in the field. And I found out that one of the biggest conventions that they have for paranormal every year, when I found out they called it Scarefest, I just rolled my eyes up into my head and shook it. I said, you got to be kidding me, man.
It really, nobody stops to think about how it reflects to the minds who are doing the actual homework of the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and developing the models and the protocols and the, you know, the real scientific digging.
I think, you know, we were talking earlier about various factions in different fields. And the paranormal isn't alone. There's other fields that are like this, too. And I think one of the factions in the paranormal are those people who get a sense of satisfaction from being knowledgeable and an expert on a field that most people don't know anything about, that most people are afraid of. And so they're knowledgeable about it, and it gives them a sense of, oh gosh, I don't want to be disrespectful. It gives them a sense of value, of worth, you know, that they know about something that most people are afraid of and don't know anything about. And so that there's another faction there that, you know, that are into the flying bats and into the gothic stuff and into the scare fest and things, because that makes it, it's like a little kid that gets off by pulling, you know, insect wings off in front of their mother to gross her out. You follow what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's almost like a roller coaster ride to them.
So we've got all these different factions, but once we begin to get a coherent picture and we have a scientifically reasonable model that we can validate with experiments and then link that with other aspects of the paranormal, we will begin to build a nucleus of credibility as a real legitimate discipline, as a real legitimate discipline field, like physics, like biology, you know, and then this other you know, Salem witch hunt, 16th century stuff will just, it needs to go away. Just needs to go away.
Right.
Yeah, because there will be no answers found and all that. It's going to be the scientific part, just like you were saying. That's just, it's why a lot of us try to protect, I almost try to protect the name of the field, because when we got into this, we're all passionate about it. And, you know, Kathy and myself, like she said, we went through our own experiences, and that's the reason why we're here now. And it's, you know, when you, some people have fun with it and all that, and they go to these locations and try to get the scare factor out of it, but that's not really, that's more, it's all good for entertainment, but it's not finding any answers to anything.
Yeah, and there'll always be a time, you know, I mean, it's exciting to do a scientific experiment. It's thrilling, and that's very credible, you know, but, you know, when somebody just, you know, when somebody develops a new technique for doing something or a new compound, they don't wrap it in spider webs and hang it on their front door for Halloween. You know, these things have to become fringe rather than what they are now, which is too much of the mainstream. And then we'll begin to attract more and more serious scientific minds. David Roundtree has told me there's a number of people he's in contact with in the established field of physics who are very interested in this, but they're afraid to cross that line because of all this other kind of stuff. They won't get involved, and we need them.
And I hate to really cut you off, but I have to. We are running out of time down to the last minute. What a fabulous guest you have been. I really
Absolutely.
Appreciate you taking the time and coming on and sharing all of this insight and knowledge and theories with us. Please get your copy of Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality by Thomas Fusco at www.cosmicveil.com. Make sure you get a copy because, man, this is what it's all about.
That's right.
And if I can add something real quick.
Sure, most definitely.
Just to let you know, I know a lot of people like to buy the book at Amazon, and I have to have it on there, but Amazon takes 40% of my royalties.
Which
if you buy it directly
yeah, not
from
good.
The publisher. Yeah, if you buy it directly from the publisher's site, I'll actually get paid the full amount for it.
There
and you
go.
And you should with the work you put in. So definitely, cosmicveil.com. CosmicVIL.com. Get your copy. Again, the title of the book is Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. Thank you so much, Thomas, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it, and I hope to hear you on Night Watch and have you back here again as well.
That'd be great. Thanks again for having me, guys. I really
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us, Thomas.
You take care and have a great evening.
Okay, you too.
You too. Bye-bye. And until next week, everybody, be good to each other. Stay tuned for Night Watch.
Parachallenged Radio is a Jackalope Radio production, simulcast on ASPRN. Join us in the chat at www.parachallengedradio.com, or you can go to jackaloperadio.com in the shows area and click on the Parachallenged Radio banner.